Hi, I'm Doug Pierce.
And I'm Jess DeBair with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial.
Welcome to Stopping By with Doug and Jess. Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet some interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you.
Thanks for joining us, and without further delay, let's see who's stopping by.
So Jess, there is quite a buzz about our podcast. This is our second guest, and our followers are building and swelling. So we're going to have to start thinking ahead about where we want our fan mail to go, who we want our representation to be. We probably, you know, we need to make them compete for our business because we are a highly sought after podcast in the
right. I mean, the agents are knocking the doors down, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. And who did you want to tap to write our jingle?
PR people. Who do I want to tap to write our jingle?
Yeah. Who do you think we should give all the royalty rights to? I mean, you could write it, I'm sure.
I mean, I could write it. I could. And then we'll harmonize and it'll be fantastic and
little
out there in the stratosphere.
Simon and Garfunkel. Would I be the Garfunkel or would I be the Simon?
You would definitely be the Garfunkel, Doug.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. I can live for that. It's a lot more high maintenance, I understand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm very excited for our next guest. I think we shouldn't keep her waiting very long. She's lived a rather interesting life. She was born in New York City to a diplomatic family from the Republic of Panama. Wanting to make her own way in the world, she pursued medicine and graduated at the top of her field. She ultimately became director of pediatric gastroenterology at Cornell University Medical Center in New York City. And after two decades of practice, she moved into the corporate side of things to help develop new therapeutics within the pharmaceutical industry. She successfully climbed the corporate ladder, retired young, and made yet another career pivot. With an extensive background in medicine, she went on to fulfill her spiritual calling. She pursued two separate postgraduate degrees simultaneously, Jess, one at Tufts University and the other at Yale Divinity School. Mm-hmm. After graduating, she became an ordained priest in the Episcopal Church and still serves her countrymen today as a COVID educator and advisor. Without any more words and any further delay, please welcome the distinguished, the Reverend Dr. Marta Ilueca. Thank you for joining us. Thank you so much for having us and being a guest of ours on this burgeoning. You're getting in at the ground level, right? So as we're taking off on this podcast, you know, you're setting a very high bar for our future guest, Marta.
Well, first of all, Doug and Jess, thank you for the invitation and the very kind words. I think that as you are familiar with my background, you have just achieved a major feat of describing a little bit of what my life has been. And I'm honored to be here with the two of you and to hopefully be able to stimulate some provocative thinking amongst your listeners.
This. Yes.
Yes. We like this a lot. And I want to start from the very beginning. And I'm thinking about, you know, your upbringing in a very distinguished family, an influential family. You had an easier path that you could have taken. Right. I'm sure there were options to just sort of hang around and ride the coattails of your influential family, but you chose to seek out a life and a career in medicine. Why do you think you did that? What do you think kind of compelled you to do something like that?
Well, based on the little blurb that you shared about me, you can tell that I am somebody who believes that human beings are mind, body, and spirit. And believe in that composite structure of our humanity. I believe that we do come to this life with a purpose, a higher purpose. And I think that having been born to a high-profile family, as you said, I was born in New York City. My father was a Latin statesman. My mother was a woman pioneer in the field of nursing. And I grew up in Panama after that appointment of my father at the United Nations. So my whole life being with a diplomatic family and a high profile family puts you in contact with people very early in life. And I was also exposed to people from all over the world. So I think that there was that curiosity about different cultures. But most importantly, my parents were tremendous role models for me and my brother. I did have a sister who passed away, actually, in her early 20s. But the role models of two people that were ahead of their time. And interestingly, all of us are Ivy Leaguers. And I think that the stakes were always high, to speak in your language.
Yeah.
The bar was always very high. But there was that spirituality in my family. I grew up in a Roman Catholic family, by the way. It was really later in life that I transitioned into the Episcopal Church. I went to Catholic school in Panama. But having that modeling in my family, I guess my exposure to this high-profile life may have been a little different, even though, yes, it sounds like I did have that choice of just enjoying the life.
Yes, right? Kicking back, just enjoying being taken care of.
But instead, it sounds like your parents would have had none of that. It sounds like
exactly. Yeah. They taught me, and my mother again was a wonderful role model, being such a woman pioneer, a nursing professional. She founded the first school of nursing in Panama. I always saw life as something that you need to grow into, where you want to give back. It was precisely because of that privileged youth, perhaps, that I learned that it was important to be appreciative. And also, with having lost one sister, the appreciation for health.
Yeah.
So that kind of put me into the path of science. I loved science. And there was that passion for science, and eventually for medicine, eventually for pediatrics. So the path started to open up, and I guess I was inspired to also make some impact. And I think that both as an American-born person that I am, I think also my Latin American upbringing, being a Latina that has achieved in the professional world, is a source of pride for me. And also in that career that you describe, also having been in medical education, training other professionals, and even in the corporate
life. When did that start? Yeah. So you started in practice. So you graduated at the top of your medical class. You start practicing. When was it that you ultimately became a director of pediatric gastroenterology? So how did that path begin?
Yeah, so I graduated in the University of Panama in 1984. I was valedictorian.
We don't have to say years. That's okay.
No.
I was going to say, too bad we don't have a video, because I was going to say, I'm not as young as I look, but I'm going to say I'm not as young as I sound.
That's good. I like that.
That's okay. I have absolutely no issues with dates. So after graduation, I did have a choice to stay in Panama because, as you said, I was at the top of the class. I was offered a couple of residencies. One was pediatrics, which is what I wanted to do. There were not that many spots in the whole country. I think there were three back then.
Wow.
So I was offered one. But I also had the opportunity to do it in the United States, and the opportunity came at Cornell University Medical Center. That's how it was called then. Now it is called Lau Medical College of Cornell University. Very long name. And the medical center there, where I did my pediatric residency and later my gastroenterology fellowship, was New York Hospital, which happens to be the place where I was born.
Full circle. That's awesome.
Full circle. I actually even visited what was my mother's room then. It was really cool, actually.
Oh, that's neat.
Yes,
that's
cool. Yeah.
It had a nice view to the East River, by the way, and East 59th Street Bridge for those New Yorkers that are listening. Yeah, so I did my residency, I did my clinical fellowship, and then I was offered a faculty position. And it was really through the years then that eventually I became a fellowship director. And towards the end of my sojourn there, I became the GI chief. We were also in transition from a previous chief into the next chief. But that is exactly when the opportunity came from there were a few pharmaceutical companies that were looking for people, but I found a good fit with AstraZeneca because of their focus on gastroenterology, which was my specialty.
Mm-hmm. Now, so were you looking to make a move out of medicine, or they sort of found you?
It was both. And this is goes back to the beginning of the interview when I said, I believe that when we see ourselves as being mind, body, and spirit, and when we believe in a higher power or a higher purpose, things tend to line up. And at that time, I was starting to be curious about other opportunities and expanding my field or what I was doing. So the right opportunity came by, and that was with AstraZeneca. And I moved to Delaware, where I still am.
Yeah.
And I directed a whole program for pediatric acid reflux. After 10, 11 years, I started to expand to other brands and started to have different roles. And as you say, climb the corporate ladder a little bit. Mm-hmm. I did not stay there to go all the way to the top. but I got to a point where it was very rewarding for me professionally and personally, again, as a Latino woman that had somehow, you know, participated in the therapeutic development of some products. Then the little bug in my ear or in my heart that came from my spirituality started to bug me again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that you said that I retired young. I think the term is early retirement, but yes, and I'll throw you another date because I don't mind dates. So in 2014, another wonderful alignment of circumstances happened because in my last assignment in the pharmaceutical industry, I met an opinion leader, a very renowned pain expert, Dr. Daniel Carr, and I hope he will listen to the podcast.
Sure.
Yes.
From Tufts.
We'll put him on the waiting list.
Okay. And as I was thinking already that I wanted to study divinity because I felt this vocational calling that I had not really addressed before in my life, and I was already in the Episcopal Church by then, I then realized that the pain program at Tufts offered me an additional specialty area. This was a master's degree in pain research, education, and policy. We used to call it PrEP. It would give me a bridge to connect my training in medicine and my new training in theology, and my Master of Divinity would be the title that I got at Yale Divinity School. That's kind of how it all came together, and then I stopped and went back to school, as you well remember.
I have to say, I really loved your position in AstraZeneca. I loved you in corporate America as a devout capitalist. We really loved you having on our team. You were very good for the company. And I want to get into your spiritual journey, but I do want to go back to working in corporate America. You rose up the ranks at a hospital and you were a leader there. And then you rose up a similar ranks in corporate America and you were a leader there. In looking at those two worlds, did you like one world or another? Were there differences, or is leadership and it's all the same? Or did you notice that in a for-profit world, it was different maybe than the hospital world?
I think that leadership is something that you have to learn. There are natural leadership abilities. And I think, and I don't want to sound presumptuous, but I think that having been born in the family where I was born, and as you know, growing up in a very small country, in a family that was striving for academic excellence, et cetera, I think I got the natural and circumstantial part of leadership. But you definitely learn leadership once you practice your career. Medicine is a service career. You really do medicine to serve others. So I would think that I learned some leadership while I was in clinical practice, but I think my more formal leadership training came in corporate, because that is just part of what you do there, is you are taught to become a leader.
You hit on a lot of things that I think you're going to naturally tie this together, because Jess and I have a lot of questions about the tying of the world of spirituality and with medicine. Because, you know, from a science perspective, and we've had a conversation like this before, which is, I would think science and spirituality are antithetical, right? You can't believe in science. You can't believe in that. And you see it very mm-hmm. differently. You made an analogy one time about it, you know, getting sunburned and, you know, the energy, you know. So talk to us about how you connect the dots between the medical world and the spirituality world and maybe dispel some of the you know, myths or what people expect versus yeah. what you really believe.
Well, this takes me back again to my Tufts program in pain research and working under the guidance of Dr. Carr and also Dr. Libby Brashe was my academic advisor, and she's still at Tufts. They knew that I had that spirituality interest, and there's no doubt that in the last decade or decade and a half, the use of complementary and alternative medicine mm-hmm. has been growing in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the NIH even has their own Institute of Complementary and Alternative Medicine. And
is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And there have been some very interesting surveys, you know, showing that a significant proportion of Americans use complementary therapies. So the key is this piece about the real spiritual piece and religion and all that. And what has become really my current focus of work is how to build a bridge that is acceptable to science, you know, and the way mm-hmm. to do that is the currency. I'm using your terms now. The currency of science is data.
Right.
I cannot go and preach to my medical colleagues and not give them data.
Data. Yeah.
You know, so what I did was my thesis for the master's program was on the use of prayer in the management of pain. And I did what's called a systematic review in which you follow a specific protocol to sort of, you know, carefully look into the major scientific databases and see what kind of data is out there regarding your chosen topic. Mm-hmm. And out of that exercise of the systematic review, I found that there was actually some substantive, although limited, data that suggested that the practice of personal prayer can be beneficial to patients with pain. And this is personal prayer. This is not group prayers. This is personal prayer.
Okay.
And through that thesis and through reading the studies that sort of made the cut, because not all the studies make the cut, I connected with Dr. Samantha Mines from Brigham and Women's Hospital. She's a clinical psychologist there in the Department of Anesthesia.
You're well networked.
Well, I also had the mentorship of a doctor pastor who's the director of the residency program in pediatrics at Yale, Benjamin Doolittle. So with these connections, we came up with a plan to develop an instrument that could measure. Now we're starting to talk science a little bit. Now we're mm-hmm. talking about
measure, yeah, mm-hmm.
or characterizing through a measure what type of personal prayer may be more helpful for people with chronic pain. You know, I obtained a grant through the Episcopal Church and developed what's called a psychometric instrument that helps to characterize the content of prayer that people with chronic pain use. And to make that very long, convoluted story short, and to go back to your question, when you can produce something that is measurable, that is validated, because there's all sorts of statistical rules about validating data.
Mm. Sure.
Then your conversation with scientists and medics is very different. Mm. So I, as a priest, can have a conversation based on data. And the data doesn't have to be positive data. It could be negative data. But mm-hmm. I can still have the conversation if I go the scientific way. So this is an example. And by the way, the instrument that we developed is called Prayers with two P's. And that stands for Pain-Related Prayer Scale. I will make sure to share the publication with you guys when it comes.
Yes.
We have presented, this year we've been very active. We have been presenting at academic conferences, right? That's the other thing you do.
Wow.
When you want to do things the academic way, scientific way. So we have presented a conference on medicine and religion, American Academy of Medicine, U.S. Association for the Study of Pain, and just 2 weeks ago at the World Congress of Pain.
I have a question about the prayer tool, because we're talking about utilizing the prayer tool for pain management, but can that be applied to stress? So I find that, personally, as a working mom, full-time working mom with two teenage children, it's hard to manage and fit everything in. And so there's a lot of stress. And so if there's a way, so can it relate to stress? Can it be applied to managing stress as it can be applied to managing pain?
Well, I'm going to give you the pastoral answer and the scientific answer.
Great.
We like this.
The pastoral answer is, of course, you can use prayer, and I'm talking prayer in general, to reduce stress. Prayer, personal prayer, and I want to underscore that. I'm talking about personal prayer by the person or with the person, okay? It's definitely a very strong suitor as a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For anything. Now, the scientific answer is that my work so far and my collaboration on the prayers instrument is for people with chronic pain. Because when we do validation of data, when you're doing research and you want to be very academic about it, very scientific about it, you have to be very focused. My hope, and I think my team's hope, is that other researchers will use the scale, because that is a measurement instrument. So now they could use it. Mm-hmm. And maybe somebody that's listening to us may be interested in trying it out for stress.
Yeah.
And then that would be a validation, in its own right. But going now back to my pastoral answer, the use of prayer as a coping mechanism, it can be used for anything. I just don't have the scientific data to tell you that, yes, it works for stress, scientifically speaking.
Yeah.
But I think the applicability does go to many, many conditions, not just chronic pain. And we will see that as more colleagues, more researchers get interested in using it. And also chaplains and pastors, right? My other set of colleagues. So to me, making the career move to the pharmaceutical industry had the goal first professionally, because I would not have done it without some kind of a professional goal, was to learn to develop new therapies. I wanted to learn that. That really excited me. But I also wanted to feel productive. And to feel productive, not only you want to be publishing or presenting in meetings, but you want to feel that you deserve to be compensated. And
did you hear that, Doug?
I heard that. Yes. Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Sure.
Should I repeat it?
No. To be compensated.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, again, in the spiritual life and the pastoral world, especially in Christian denominations, and I am a Christian, so I say it with respect, there is a misunderstanding sometimes of the teachings, in that sometimes it is thought that we should just work and work and work and serve and serve and serve. And we shouldn't expect to be compensated.
Mm.
And if we get...
Like it's a dirty word, like it's a bad word. Yeah.
Well, there is something... there are a couple of things in the Bible, right? Because that's kind of the center of our teachings that gets misinterpreted. And I always, when somebody asks me, I say, well, if you're a Christian, right? And not everybody's a Christian. So this is just an example. But if you're a Christian, then there's no reason for you to think that you should not prosper and that you should not be compensated. Because the central figure of Christianity, Jesus of Nazareth, said that laborers must be paid. Okay.
So, yeah. So if you're financially fit, you're spiritually fit.
Well, if you're
and that affords you time to continue to give back.
Yeah, well, what is not healthy is to make money the center of your universe. That's a whole different picture.
Sure.
Right.
Because then you're not even going to be enjoying your own life, waiting for the next market thing or the next dividends. And let me, and that's the way that I think we ended up, in this professional, should I call it collaboration?
Relationship.
Relationship.
Yeah.
Was that I wanted self-care. I wanted to feel productive. I was perhaps in a better space to think about that. Mm-hmm. Right. And I thought one of the things that I have appreciated more from your group is educating me so that I understand what's happening with my assets.
Yeah.
And being part of certain decisions. And also, as you and Jess know very well, planning for the future.
At what point did you become a Reiki master in all of this? Can you tell us about that?
Oh, of course. I became a Reiki master a few years before I became an Episcopalian. And it was precisely because of this interest or vocation that I had inside to look into spiritual health and spiritual right. healing.
Mm-hmm. And can you, for our listeners, explain exactly what a Reiki master is and does?
Great.
Yeah, Reiki is a healing tradition from Japan. There are two branches. There's a branch in the United States also, where basically you are trained. It goes from a lineage of teachers.
Okay.
So you need to be trained by somebody who's already...
You apprenticed and... Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And basically the principle of Reiki is that you learn to function as a channel of healing energy based on the idea that there is a universal source. It goes back to the beginning of our talk today, that mm-hmm. one source, one God, one creator, one higher power, whichever your spirituality indicates to you.
New York Stock Exchange. No, go ahead. Okay. Sorry. Yes, from the higher power, I'm with you.
Nordstrom. Yeah.
But yeah, so you are trained with special meditations and special gestures. You're trained to channel that energy towards somebody who wants healing or who just wants to be strengthened or who wants to clean up their energies. Okay. So that's called Reiki, R-E-I-K-I.
And how do you apply it exactly? So you're channeling it. How do you get it to the other person?
Well, when the person comes looking for it, because one of the precepts of or tenets of Reiki is that the person needs to ask for healing.
Yeah, sure.
Ah, okay. You have to be receptive to it.
You don't go pushing.
You're not just
people.
Like, I'm going to give you some Reiki.
Whoa.
Some Reiki for you? Okay.
Right. You can offer it, but the person has to want it.
And does it apply for your own wellness?
Yes.
Your own health, your own
yes.
wellness? Like you are helping others, obviously, in channeling the energy, but how does it affect you yes. personally to do so?
Yeah, that was one of the original precepts of the original teachers is self-healing.
Self-healing.
Because
yeah.
you need to self-heal if you want to heal others. You know?
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, there are some
you have to be financially competent to help yes. people become financially yes. competent. Yeah.
So there's definitely a good portion of the training that goes into self-cleaning your system, your energies, and self-healing. Yeah. And I find it particularly useful besides self-care. For that, I do use it regularly with my prayer life, meditation life, etc. But I find that it is actually very, very helpful for acute injuries. It's been my personal observation. I don't have research on that. I mean, there are papers published, but it's just my own observation that when you use it at the beginning of an injury or even at the beginning of a cold or something, mm-hmm. that's when it works the best. Mm-hmm. And my explanation for that is that it is the energy works to strengthen you and curtail whatever it is that is happening to you. But when it's,
I would imagine you're most receptive. Somebody, the receiver is most receptive because they're up against it in a hard place.
Yeah. And when you have very, very advanced illnesses, it might be more difficult for it to work because at that time, we go back here to mind, body, and spirit. Your body still needs to have some healing reserve. And if there's a disease that has really debilitated the body, then the healing is much more difficult.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's what I love to hear about with you talking, this passion for service is there. And again, we share that as well. What's fascinating and what I love about this job is, and it's similar to your job, what people think you do versus what you actually do are very different. And in, you know, in our world, they think, oh, it's only spreadsheets and pie charts. And the reality is our job is really to draw out your aspirations. Mm-hmm. What are you trying to accomplish? And getting to know you over the years, you have been laser focused on what you want, where you need to go, and very clear about that, which has made our relationship so great, because I don't have to guess what you're thinking. You know, I don't have to help you. You know, my job is to just make sure that we can accomplish that. And that is a fulfilling part. It's what gives us a lot of our, you know, refills our spiritual cup, because we watch people have these plans and then see them through to fruition. And it's a really rewarding thing to be a part of. So, you know, we thank you for sharing that journey with us and how you did all this.
What is next for you, Dr. Marcha? What's next?
That depends on you guys.
We aim to serve.
I want to just as a segue to what Doug is saying, and my God, kudos to Jess. You have the best programs for innovative thinking, for nurturing the mind. Please don't stop that. But I have to say that a couple of things from my relationship with you guys through the years, besides the self-care piece and the ability to have a vision that is doable, I think is very important, especially for goal-oriented people. And I'm sure a lot of your clients, if not most, are goal-oriented. Mm-hmm. The peace of mind that will come from having your finances in order.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for giving and being so gracious of your time, giving your feedback and sharing with all of our listeners your journey from where you are, where you're now, and where you're headed. We can't thank you enough. Reverend Dr. Marta Ilueca.
Thank you,
Doug and Jess. Thank you very much for having me.